Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So from the consumer viewpoint, if someone cares about this sort of things and they want to buy the product that supports healthy philosophies, what advice would you give them?
Gosh. That's a hard answer. That's a hard answer. You know, you can go to most websites and they'll mention that, you know, some of the, there's always a catchphrase that talks about their practices. But to find out whether they're really deeply committed takes much more investigation, and you know, it's networking with people and asking questions. And you know, if they're purchasing wine in a wine shop, hopefully the people that they're talking with are knowledgeable about the labels that they represent and know something about the individual operations and can speak to them. You know, it can never hurt to make a phone call to the actual operation and ask. It's largely, unfortunately, it's one of those issues where the consumer has to, it's consumer beware and consumer be educated.
Exactly. So the onus is really on the consumer and the buyer. There's no simple shortcut.
Exactly.
Just because it says on the label,
right,
you buy at your own risk.
Right.
So if you really care, do research.
Exactly.
Let's talk about biodynamics. That's another area of massive confusion in the winemaking community, actually, as I was surprised to learn, is that there's, again, you so eloquently put, you ask four questions, you get six answers. I've gotten quite a few different versions of the importance and the relevance. So what is your take on biodynamics?
It's an organizational system that prioritizes the health of the environment. As outlined by Rudolf Steiner, it's strictly the nine preparations and how they're used. The thing that's exciting about the biodynamic community is that they're also doing a lot of exploration in with other practices. It's a method to try and minimize outside inputs and still a maximum amount of quality as a product. And it really looks at the long-term health of a property. I mean, so much of our industry really is blinded by the five-year view, and we really have to remember that it's the 20-year, it's the 100-year outlook that we need to respect and really think about.
You know, I've had that sentiment before, the 100-year plan. You know, when you plant a vineyard, it takes, what, 4 or 5 years for it to even really produce. So there's such inherent lag time, and this is not a labor of quick. This is a labor of patience, viticulture in general and agriculture. And that planning for next generation and maybe generations is part of the philosophy of those that really understand.
Right, and I think biodynamics embraces that philosophy probably better than any other farming system.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, something that we do every year as an industry is we put together budgets forecasting the costs for the coming year, but how many of us actually write a written farm plan for each year about where we want to improve our practices? Something that is really important and rarely explored. It takes a huge time commitment. It's complicated. Having that written guideline for you that you can constantly refer back to really helps keep that focus towards the end goal, which is, you know, that year's harvest first off, and then the subsequent harvests after that also.
Is it a more costly proposition to practice?
No, it's more just time consuming. It's a matter of sitting at the desk and disciplining yourself to actually write a word, not just put numbers to paper, but put words to paper so you can use it. It's a journaling that you can use as a reference as the year progresses.
Hmm. And what are the physical aspects of it? I know, again, people are confused about the whole bearing the horn and the protocol of what biodynamics.
Right.
Can you talk about it?
Not in a short summary. I'm going to stumble here for a second.
No problem. No, there's a lot of complexities to it.
A lot of people try and explain biodynamics in a spiritual sense.
Right.
And I have a little bit of trouble with that.
Okay.
I'm trained in the sciences, and I have to look at it scientifically. And I think what happens is that the benefit of biodynamics is that it maximizes the biological health of a system, whether it's microbial down on a small scale in the soil, or more on a macro scale, the environment that the vineyard is actually in and the animals that are there and living in there. A good example is you referenced the horn manure that's mm-hmm. buried in a cow horn mm-hmm. Around the fall equinox, and then dug up around the spring equinox. Mm-hmm. It's very rich, humic material that's used in very small quantities and applied on the ground. And my explanation of what it does is it serves as a catalyst for organic long chain molecules to develop from.
Mm-hmm.
Invariably, biodynamic vineyards have higher organic matter in the soil. And my explanation for that is because of the catalytic effect of the horn manure.
Interesting. You know, it's a pretty polarizing subject.
Mm-hmm.
There are believers and there are those that just think it's, you know, pooey.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the fact that you have such a practical approach, you know, coming at it from anything but scientific, practical perspective.
Well, I've found myself in having to defend it fairly often. There's people that rightfully question the validity of biodynamics, because a lot of times biodynamics is presented in a way that says that this will solve all of your problems.
Hmm.
And I think any time that people make that claim, we have to question that. There's still a lot of challenges to farming, and you cannot use just the biodynamic preparations to accomplish what those goals are.
So no silver bullet, but if you could influence other viticulturalists, mm-hmm. would you like to see that practice in the field in Napa Valley,
hmm.
or?
I would like to see it used more.
Okay.
You know, one of the things, the biodynamic calendar is largely based on astronomical
mm-hmm.
Events,
mm-hmm.
and I want to distinct that from astrological events. It's truly astronomical. Okay. There's moon phases and planetary phases that can be used as an organization. And a good example here at Stag's Leap is that vineyards that are weak. I have 200 acres that I need to take care of.
Yeah.
Pruning. I cannot prune those all on an astronomical event and get the job done.
Yes.
So the way I do that is the weak vineyards, I will go ahead and prune on those more beneficial periods, because I think that they can benefit from it the most. But and on the other hand, a block that's strong, that's delivering good fruit, that we're confident of its quality, I'm maybe a little bit more liberal and willing to do my farming practices when it maybe might not be as beneficial as the biodynamic calendar claims.
So again, I'm hearing not dogmatic approach, but practical approach, what makes sense, what fits your mm-hmm. vineyard. It's all contextual, isn't it?
It's contextual, yeah.
Very good. Let's go back in time to 2006 when you were first lured. Was it Warren that approached you, or?
Ultimately, it was Warren that I talked with and discussed a lot with. I think he was attracted to my knowledge of soils, and I was very attracted to his knowledge of canopies. And I learned a lot about canopies through Warren, and have made that now a permanent part of my farming knowledge.
I didn't realize that he was such a renowned viticulturalist.
He's a man of many talents and studies things deeply, and viticulture was a part of that as well as winemaking.
Wow! So he's also perhaps considered a mentor by you, or
Definitely. He, especially like I said, in from the concept of canopy management.
Yeah. Were there other people along the way that influenced you? Robert Sinsky sounds like his one.
Robert Sinsky. Yeah. And Jeff Vernig worked with Alan York quite a bit with biodynamics. Robert Craig was a mentor.
Okay. Yeah.
Lori Wood. Gosh, I'm leaving people out. So.
Oh, I'm sure you had many people along your journey that were important. I was just curious if there's some that popped up. So when you first started working here, was it very different from what you experienced at other wineries? Or
yeah, it was different. I mean, there was a great deal of pride taken in the prominence of Stag's Leap Wine Cellars.
Of course.
And so everybody felt a vested interest in what happened, both out in the vineyard and in the winery. And so there was a lot of idea exchange, mm-hmm. and a lot of discussion about what would be the best courses of action to take out here, whether it was irrigation or cover cropping, even how we would till and develop young vineyards. So there was a great deal of discussion at all times. It wasn't always convenient, but it was exciting and offered a really neat forum to take this second. So I think of Sinsky as the first big step in my farming career. Mm-hmm. There was many small steps prior to that. Mm-hmm. And then Stag's Leap was by far the most prominent second step in that process.
So it sounds like a very thoughtful approach that was practiced here, and very collaborative with other people.
A lot of collaboration. That's the word I was looking for earlier. Yeah.
Wow. So 200 acres. Well, at the time it was less.
So it's 100. I'm sorry. So it's 145 acres.
Okay.
That here at Stag's Leap. The, mm-hmm. That's the Fay and SLV vineyards, which right. are right here where we're talking, and then Danica Vineyard on Big Ranch Road.
Okay.
And then Warren's place on Olive Hill Road, which he kept after the sale to St. Michelle and the Antonori family.
Interesting.
And I think he recognized that he really wanted to keep his hands in the business and wanted to stay busy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it's a beautiful little piece of property, and so he chose to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Proud to say that we continue to buy fruit from him for our programming here.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And the vineyards are formed in a very similar manner, right? Or are
yeah.
they different? Okay.
Well, Warren has his own management team
sure.
For his property, but a lot of attention to detail and again, a very collaborative practice out there as well.
I would imagine so, yeah. So stepping into this big shoes, meaning it's such a historic property,
mm-hmm.
I mean, really, for the purposes of California history, this is it, number one. Judgment of Paris. There's only one number one, so it must be a bit of pressure, and also, like you said, very stimulating, very interesting. What were your goals initially, like when you were discussing farming practices and such like that? Obviously, producing the best wine you can, but what were some of the specifics?
My first goal was to use 100% of the estate fruit
okay.
for the estate program,
yeah.
and that still remains a goal. So typically there's the best fruit that's used for Cask 23, FAY and SLV, and then what wasn't used for that program would go into the Artemis label, along with purchased fruit from outside growers. And so as a vineyard manager here on this property, if I can use 100% of the fruit in the estate program, gosh, what a neat feather in the cap. We've gotten close. I've never been able to pull it off at 100%, but it will always remain a goal to do that sometime.
Very good. Any other goals that you can...
I wanted to bring a greater deal of sustainability to this property, and I wanted to use the skills that I had learned, the craft that I had learned from my mentors, and apply them here, and then and take something that was great and make it even greater. And I think that has to be the goal. It's just like I always equate it with playing the World Series. You know, it's not over until the seventh game, and so you got to keep trying and striving for improvement every vintage.
That sounds pretty evergreen.
Yeah.
You mentioned Cast 23, so I just wanted to quick ask you to tell the listeners, it's a flagship wine. So
right.
What is the story behind Cast 23?
The story behind Cast 23 was that Warren used Andrei Telichev as a consultant, and they were going through the winery. Andrei came across a particular cask of wine that was in his mind remarkable, and told Warren that he needed to bottle it separately. And that just so happened that that was Cask 23.
Interesting.
And it's been a part of the program ever since. It's not done every year. The last time we didn't bottle it was in 2011, which was a very challenging farming year. And I really have to give credit to St. Michel and the Antonori family for the decision not to bottle it, because by not making Cask 23, we actually made FAY and SLV better wines than they would have been otherwise. So by kind of recognizing that maybe it wasn't a year that was as remarkable as we are lucky enough to experience here in California pretty frequently, they chose not to bottle it, and instead really focus on maximizing the quality of the FAY and the SLV wines that year.
Have you met Andrei? Have you worked with him?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, Andrei Telichev?
Yeah, Andrei Telichev.
He actually passed away quite a while ago.
Yeah.
So I never had the opportunity to meet him.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it happened. He's such a legend.
It would have been great. Yeah.
So, winemaking.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times you and the winemaker obviously are joined at the hip. It has to be that way during certain times, or perhaps all the time. How do you see that relationship?
Again, it's a collaboration. I'm really fortunate. Our winemaker, Marcus Nataro, is a very skilled vineyard eye, and he's out in the vineyard a lot. And very early in the season, and so what that allows him to do is to really begin interpreting the climate of the vintage, the health of the vines, and the quality of the fruit that's out there. And he begins very early on visualizing what he plans to do at harvest, and how to execute on that. So he's constantly talking with me and sharing his observations, and you know, we discuss what are best practices for that year. I mean, if a year is cool and wet, you have to approach it one way, and if it's hot and dry, you have to approach it differently, and we begin that process very early on.
How long has he been with Stag's
Leap? His first vintage was 2013.
Okay, so who was there before that?
It was Nikki Pruse.
Okay.
And she'd been here for quite a while as well. She was working with Warren gosh, I think started in the late 90s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And started in the vineyard and then moved into the winery.
Fascinating. So the current winemaker, do you always agree or do you have arguments?
We often discuss our own personal views, and, okay. and you know, in one of the things that's really important for me is that he is my customer. I am delivering grapes to him, and so it's important to me that I deliver a product that he's confident in, because it allows him just that much more freedom when he's making those wines. So yeah, we will discuss and disagree, but ultimately, you know, we come to our goals are the same, and that goal is to create the best wine we possibly can. And so, when you have a commonality of a goal like that, it's pretty easy to give and take come to a more of a consensual type of agreement than something that's dictated.
When you taste in the vineyard during harvest, what do you look for when you taste the fruit?
I'm going to be really honest. My skill at tasting is not of tasting fruit and visualizing what that wine is going to be is difficult.
Okay.
Marcus, on the other hand, has a really good palate for that. You know, but it's the same thing where you're looking for skin maturity. I'm speaking about Cabernet right now.
Of course.
Skin maturity, density of the pulp, seed color. You really want to make sure that the green flavors that can become quite prominent in Cabernet are resolved. But one of the ways that we accomplish that is much earlier in the season, prior to harvest, and that's how we treat the canopies. Again, going back to my knowledge that was shared with through Warren. It's how do we size the canopies as far as canopy height, how do we irrigate, how do we fruit thin, and how do we leaf around the fruit zone to maximize air and light, but still make sure that that fruit is protected from excessive sunlight.
And it's through experience that these things are worked out to whatever
it is for me. I'm a seat of the, I fly by the seat of my pants a lot. To me, the technology that has become so prominent in our industry are great reference points, but you also have to have a certain amount of just gut feeling that's really important to use when you're making your decisions.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been advancements, major advancements. It's exponential. I mean, I heard of the sensors that attach to the vine and actually measure the health of it.
The sap sensors. Yeah, exactly. They're able to measure flow of water into and out of the vine. So there's a shrink-swell cycle, to use almost like a biodynamic term, daily, and these sap sensors are actually able to measure that. But the one problem with a sap sensor is measuring one point. And then you can put out an array of sap sensors, which are measuring multiple points, but again, they're typically concentrated in one area. So you have to be able to take that and extrapolate it out to the greater acreage that you're farming. And I think that's really where your experience comes through and where you can make decisions that might not be exactly in line with what the technology is telling you, but it's still a great tool. And it's just like harvest. When a winemaker says that they want to pick on flavor, doesn't mean they're not checking Brix, TA, and pH. It just means that they still are really looking for a flavor component also. But I don't know any winemaker that would see signals in the grape sampling that says, hey, these grapes are beyond their prime and are beginning to fall apart. I think he would go ahead and pick, even if he felt that flavors were not quite where he wanted them to be, because ultimately we want to make the best product we possibly can. And not every year is ideal. And so the way you, again, you're using technology as a reference point, but you really want to draw on your experience to make those decisions.
So great tools, but there's no substitute for that human mind and
exactly.
human eye. You know, it really stood out to me when you said earlier that you can walk into a property and you can take like the SWOT analysis quick of the vineyard.
Very much, yeah.
And you know what it's about. You already have a ton of information just from the sheer
right.
observation.
And the way that, you know, and that's a developed skill also. So I was lucky enough to have a certain minimal level of that, even at a very young age. But then as time progresses and it becomes muscle memory, you can walk into a vineyard on a weekly basis and you can all of a sudden realize that, hey, the things are not where I want them to be, or you can say, oh, this is exactly the way it should be. And those can be very quick decisions if you have the experience of knowledge behind you to help know what you're looking at.
2011 was clearly an outlier, very, very challenging for most. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, the other vintages, let's just say that followed 12, 13, 14, I hear great things about it. A taste, mini, you mm-hmm. know, much proof of concept. Are they pretty similar viticulturally in terms of when you look at what's happening in the vineyard? Is it similar behavior?
12, 13, and 14 were all kind of Goldilocks vintages.
Okay.
And so, yeah, there was a kind of a commonality. We didn't really have to adjust much. But then you have a year like 2015, right on the heels of these three great vintages, which was 2015 was the hottest vintage on record in the Napa Valley. And certainly we had to make changes then. I would probably leaf a little bit less aggressively so that I had more protection over the fruit. Mm-hmm. Certainly had to irrigate a little bit more than I would typically because once those vines dehydrate, they're very hard to revive and keep healthy. Mm-hmm. Especially, we did the Napa Valley did a large replanting in the 1990s as a result of phylloxera. Mm-hmm. And some of the vines that we planted, we were trying to use denser plantings, and we were using rootstocks that made smaller vines. Well, we learned that those vines are also thirstier vines. Oh. And we had to, and so we had a vintage like 2015, and we definitely had to compensate for that. There's a pretty big move afoot right now with replanting again, maybe not on an emergency basis, mm-hmm. but people are more thoughtful in their replantings. And one of the things that we're doing is that we're going back to rootstocks that survive drought better.
Interesting.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.